Right, thank you very much. Well, I'm thankful for this time to round off what I had to say, because it seemed rather abrupt to end by talking about the slaughter of the Amalekites and the Canaanites, and I hate to finish on a downbeat. I think that on an occasion like this, when we are discussing such an august subject as the nature of God, his omniscience, his omnipotence, and his omnipresence, we have to end on an upbeat. I think we need that. And I was delighted when that psalm was read on last evening, Psalm 139, the first 18 verses, because in my book that's one of the most beautiful of all the psalms. You know, the five books of wisdom, it's generally said that the book of Job taught the Jew how to suffer, and the book of Proverbs taught him wisdom, the book of Ecclesiastes taught him how to live, and the Song of Solomon taught him how to love, but the psalms taught him how to praise. And it certainly was the book of praise for God's ancient people. In fact, we say a book of praise. In reality, as I'm sure you Bible students know, there are five books of Psalms, 150 Psalms divided into five books. And I want you to turn, if you will, to Psalm 139, and I want to read the first 18 verses again, because this, I think, is something that's very wonderful and is well worthy of our attention. Psalm 139. O Yahweh, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest when I sit down and when I rise up. Thou discernest my thoughts from afar. Thou searchest out my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, lo, O Yahweh, thou knowest it altogether. Thou dost beset me behind and before, and layest thy hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain it. Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend to heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in Sheol, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there thy hand shall lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, let only darkness cover me, and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to thee. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with thee. Thou didst form my inward parts. Thou didst knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise thee, for thou art fearful and wonderful. Wonderful are thy works. Thou knowest me right well. My frame was not hidden from thee when I was being made in secret, intricately wrought in the depths of the earth. Thy eyes beheld my unformed substance. In thy book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there were none of them. How precious to me are thy thoughts, O God! How vast is the sum of them! If I would count them, they are more than the sand. When I awake, I am still with thee. A very moving psalm, isn't it? A very wonderful psalm. It is. The first 18 verses are divided, I think, into three sections. The first six verses speak of the omniscience of God. You notice that the writer there says, Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest me when I sit down, when I rise up. Thou discernest my thoughts from afar and searchest out my path and my lying down. He goes on to say, even before a word is on my tongue, lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. The omniscience of God. The next six verses speak of the omnipresence of God. Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or whither shall I flee from thy presence? And he goes on to point out that he can't do that. If he goes to heaven, well, God is there. If he goes where he doesn't expect God to be, down in Sheol, the place of the dead, God is there. If he takes the wings of the morning and goes as far as he possibly can, across the sea, God is there. And he says, even there thy hand shall lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me or cover me. Then the final six verses of the 18 verses there, 7 to 12, speak of the omnipotence of God. He says, thou didst form my inward parts. There's a verse in Isaiah 44 and verse 24 that you might want to note. Thus saith Yahweh, your Redeemer, who formed you from the womb, I am Yahweh who made all things. And he goes on to speak of the way in which God's power is manifested. It's truly a marvelous psalm. And after talking about those Canaanites, those troublesome Amalekites as well, and worse still, after trying to defend God as if he needed defended from critical thoughts, I'd like us to have a look at this rather constructive and more positive psalm. I think it will be helpful to ask the question, by the way, I'm not going to go over some of the stuff I've left out because that's out of context now. I've done with that. Okay? So I won't keep you more than half an hour, I promise you. I think it will be helpful to ask that question, what does the omniscience of God as revealed in the Old Testament mean to people like you and me today? Well, there are many passages in which there's omniscience and the all-knowing. I don't know if that's a real word. It's not in my dictionary. I may have made it up. I don't know. The all-knowingness of God. I think it's a good word anyway. The all-knowingness of God, the fact that he knows everything. What does it mean to people like you and me? Well, this is a psalm because in which the psalmist expresses him awestruck, amazed at the intimate knowledge that God has of his life. He's not expressing wonder so much at God's consummate knowledge about the vast creation with its myriad of creatures and life forms in it, with its worlds beyond worlds and the complexity of natural laws that operate in it. That's not what concerns him here. He's amazed at God's concern for him, one small creature. Just one creature in this vast universe. It's a very special psalm for that reason. Now, I know that you love the psalms if you're students of the Word of God, and so you ought to be. But this is a very special psalm in a number of ways. In fact, let me tell you, it's a psalm that is unique in the whole range of ancient literature. And it's unsurpassed in my book anyway by anything that you're going to find in the Old Testament. But it's a psalm that presents us with a number of very interesting puzzles. At least I find them interesting. Let me begin by saying something that you may or may not have thought about, and it's this, that David did not write all of the psalms. David did not write all of the 150 psalms in the five books into which they're divided. At the end of Psalm 72, you'll find the statement, the psalms of David, the son of Jesse, are ended. And it's generally taken to mean that David was personally responsible for the writing of the psalms in the first two divisions. We have three further divisions after that, and it's considered by the scholars, and I think with a good deal of right, that David edited these, arranged them, organized them, psalms which others composed for use in the temple that was being planned and which Solomon, his son, would be allowed to build. Now you might say, how do you know that? How do you know that David didn't write all the psalms? Well, it seems to me all you have to do is to look at the psalms and you'll find that for yourselves. For example, after the second division of the book, Psalm 73 to Psalm 83, 11 psalms are described as psalms of Asaph, one of the Levites. And then There are 10 other psalms which are labeled Psalms of the Sons of Korah. They were Levites who served in the temple too. Psalm 72 itself is described as a psalm of Solomon. Psalm 89 is described as a psalm of Ethan the Ezrahite. And then Psalm 90 is a psalm of Moses, the man of God. So it seems quite evident that David was not responsible for writing all of the psalms, but he may well have gathered together a great number of them. And this Psalm 139 is in that last section of five books. It's actually described as a psalm of David, but it seems to me, and there's evidence for this, that David took that psalm and edited and used it in his collection, and I'll explain why in a moment. There's a very intriguing fact about the psalm, this particular one, and it is that it is full of ancient Semitic words that were not used in David's time. If you're wondering why I'm telling you this, it'll become clear in a moment or two, I hope anyway. Words that were not used in David's time, that's what I'm talking about now. In the book of Genesis, in the time of Genesis, in the time of the patriarchs, there were quite a number of Semitic languages or dialects that were in common use, used by the descendants of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And the language of that time contained a word for God which was not in use in the time of David. For example, we've talked about Elohim and Adonai. We've talked about El, the singular number. We've talked about Yahweh. The word that is used for God in this psalm is Eloah. Eloah. And it was not you. It's almost as if we were to go back to Anglo-Saxon. How many of us would understand Anglo-Saxon today? I think most of us have a problem understanding Shakespeare, don't we? We do. But Anglo-Saxon, we can't even read it. Well, it was the same situation in the time of David. The language, the ancient Semitic language from which Eloah came, had long since become obsolete. So this is a different word for God. The word Elohim that I've mentioned occurs 368 times in the Psalms alone. This word, Eloah, in 150 Psalms, only occurs three times. But I'll tell you where you'll find it. You'll find it in the book of Job, 41 times. And there's something else to hear. Just before the word God in the 19th verse, there's an even rarer word. And that's the word for slay. It's translated slay or to kill. It's the word katar. Now, that really is unusual because that word only occurs one more time in the whole of the Old Testament. And guess where you'll find it? In the book of Job. Only once in the book of Job. Now, I remember hearing a lecturer at Manchester University. We were studying the book of Job, and he said that the book of Job belonged to the post-exilic period. Now, I don't know if you know what that means. It means that he said that the book of Job was written after the return from the Babylonian captivity. And he said the book of Job was written by the priests in order to bolster their authority on the return from captivity. So I stood up, well, as you might expect, I stood up, and I said, well, if this book comes after the time of the Babylonian captivity, why do I read in Job chapter 1, verse 5, that Job offered sacrifices on behalf of his children? And there's no mention of priests in the entire book. I said, surely it belongs to the patriarchal period rather than to the priestly period. And he looked at me, and he said, well, thank you for that observation. I hadn't thought about that. That's amazing, isn't it, that a man in a university would say that. I hadn't thought about it. No, the point is that the book of Job belongs to the time of the book of Genesis. It doesn't belong in the middle of the Bible historically. chronologically, it belongs to the early time, to the time of the book of Genesis, to the time of the patriarchs. Every evidence in the book points that way. So what it means is here is a psalm originating with someone who probably existed in the time of Genesis and the patriarchal age, and he's speaking of the omniscience of God in this very wonderful way. By the way, don't let yourself be troubled by any suggestion that the book of Psalms in its entirety was not written by David, because there are various books in the Old Testament about whom there are questions as to authorship or who wrote it anyway. Settle your mind on the fact that thanks to the inspiration of the Spirit of God, the ultimate author of every book in the Bible is God. Doesn't matter who wielded the pen. I don't have to know his name. I only need to know that it came from God himself, that the Spirit is behind everything here. And as I said earlier on, everything we read about God in these books was written by the revelation of God himself through the Holy Spirit. Now here's where we get back on theme. Here in Psalm 139 we have a psalm of pure worship from the very earliest times. And he's expressing wonder that God knows him through and through, knows the most intimate details of his life. He's overwhelmed, he's humbled, he's subdued by the fact of the omniscience of God. And he says, God knows all about me because he created me. Omniscience. And then, of course, the omnipresence of God. That amazes him, too. You can almost hear the amazement in his voice. Where am I going to go? How can I escape from him? Where can I go where he is not? And the very simple answer is, nowhere. No hiding place from God, ever. God is there wherever you go. And then finally, this is what I want to come on to. The third point is God's omnipotence. If you look at that verse 13, you'll find that it begins with a conjunction. And you know that a conjunction is a joining word. He says, verse 12, darkness is as light with thee. Then verse 13 begins, for thou didst form my inward parts and didst knit me together in my mother's womb. You get the same thought in Job chapter 10, verse 11, incidentally. My frame was not hidden from thee when I was being made in secret, intricately wrought in the depths of the earth. And by the way, he says, thine eyes saw my unformed substance. In thy book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there were none of them. Now, do you realize what this man is saying? Because I think he understood something about the relationship between God and man that is evidently passing people by today. Something of which many people are ignorant. This man knows something about life and the birth of human beings which is dismissed in this age, in this society. There is no compunction, no qualm of conscience about terminating the life of a child unborn. Here in the early days of Bible history is somebody who says, look, even before my body was formed in the womb, you already knew all about me. Even before my days existed, every one of my days was written in your book. You saw my frame being formed. You put together my frame, my bodily frame, and every part of my being, even before I had an existence, and even before my days existed, every one was written in your book. I will praise thee, for thou art fearful and wonderful. An alternative rendering would be, I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. And the text will stand both translations. Now here's the thing. If that was true of him, the psalmist, it's just as true of you. It was evidently a comfort to this man to know that God knew him so well, and that even before he was born, God had an interest in him. And it ought to be so to us, you know. It ought to give us comfort to know that our God knows all about us. Everything. And I do mean everything. He says, thou knowest me right well. And you know, that's the thought that's expressed over and over again in the Old Testament. Psalm 44, verse 21, he knows the secrets of the heart. Ezekiel 11, verse 5, the prophet says, or rather God says through the prophet, I know the secret things that come into your mind. Every one of them. That's amazing, isn't it? That God knows what comes into your mind. Every single thought. And then again, in the Psalm of Moses, in Psalm 90, verse 8, thou hast set our iniquities before thee, our secret sins in the light of thy countenance. We can hide nothing from God. Now, let me assure you that I'm not concerned this morning to dwell on that aspect of God's omniscience. I don't think we'd get a great deal of comfort from knowing that God knows our secret thoughts and all about us. I think about this, Jesus as the I Am. You remember the woman taken in adultery there in John chapter 8? When Jesus stooped and wrote with his finger in the sands, and beginning with the eldest down to the youngest, they went away. One ancient Peshitto-Syriac manuscript says, he wrote upon the ground the sin of each one of them. If that's true, well, I can understand why they disappeared as they did. Can't you? But there's something else. Jesus said, let him among you who is, well, we often say, let him among you who is without sin, in the generic sense. He didn't say that. The word that he uses means, let him among you who is without her kind of sin be the first to cast a stone. The word that he uses is the word anamartitos, and it refers to a specific kind of sin in classical Greek. So Jesus didn't say, let him among you without sin, but let him among you who is not guilty of her kind of sin be the first to cast a stone. Well, would you deal with a God like that? You don't want to talk too much about that aspect of his omniscience, do you? And I don't want to do that right now. Instead, I want to finish off my little section by pointing out that because we're Christians, God's intimate knowledge of our lives and God's concern for our lives works in our favor. And it should be a source of great blessing to us. For example, Psalm 139 ought to be a psalm that you consider not only in moments of deepest need, but in moments of deepest devotion, to express the closeness, the nearness that you have with God. Now, when you look at this man's psalm, there's nothing philosophical about it. There's nothing theological about it. He talks about God, knowing everything about him, and being everywhere present, but they're not for theological discussion. It's not open to argument here. He's talking about facts. He's talking about realities. He's talking about something of which he's absolutely convinced. And grasp this. He talks about God's omniscience and omnipotence and omnipresence in a way that shows that he's not scared. Of course, if you have a guilty conscience, you may well be scared. When you think about a God who knows all about you, and a God from whom you can't hide, and a God who can do anything with you that he pleases. But this man's not afraid to talk about God knowing all about him. Do you know why? Because he knows that God cares for him. And that's why he's able to say, how precious are thy thoughts to me. And when I am awake, I'm still with thee. Do you know what comes out of this psalm for me? And I am really going to wind up now, because you've had enough of me for a while anyway, and you've been very patient today. I'm sure you're getting oxygen starved. I'll tell you what comes out of the psalm for me, and I really am summing it up briefly. That here is a man who is conscious of the love of God, even in those distant days, and a man who himself loves God. He sees himself in the hand of a God who's all-powerful, but he knows that the hand that garnished the heavens is a hand that cares for him. I like the words of Jesus. He says, "My sheep hear my voice, and they follow me. And I give unto them eternal life, and they shall never perish. Neither shall any man pluck them out of my hand." Now listen. "Neither shall any man pluck them out of my hand. My Father who gave them to me is greater than all, and no man shall pluck them out of my Father's hand." You talk about double security. Well, if you're a Christian, you have it. Because you're not only the hand of the Lord Jesus, but the hand of God's around you both. You're in the hand of God. And it's amazing that the psalmist says, "Though thou art the great and high God who inhabits eternity, yet thou dost condescend to be near also to him of a contrite spirit." Imagine that. God who scattered the stars through space, who maintains the universe by his powerful word, is close to you, and he's concerned to be near to anyone of a contrite spirit. Ellen Thorncroft Fowler told about a clergyman visiting an old man who was close to death, and he was rather afraid, to put it bluntly. And he said to the clergyman, "You know, I have served God and I've feared him all of my life." And his visitor said, "That may be so, but have you loved and trusted him?" The dying man lay silent for a moment with his eyes closed. Then he looked up at his visitor and he said, "I wonder if you're not right, and I've misjudged him all these years. Do you think you'll forgive me?" His visitor said, "I'm sure of it. Although it must be hard even for God to be misjudged by the people that he loves." But God knows you. That's the kind of God the Old Testament reveals, as well as the New. And God desires your fellowship and your love. You've served God for how many years? You feared him, certainly. But have you loved him? Have you loved him? Thank you. That's all I have to say.